The following workshop was recorded at the 7th Annual Pittsburgh Classical Christian Education Conference. For more information about the conference, visit the Blackburn Study Center website at www.blackburnstudycenter.org.
All right, well, I see that it's 1:30 by official conference time up there. Is that the official conference clock? Why not? Okay. Well, this is my last talk of the day. So today, this talk is teaching critical thinking. Like last time, there are talks available, but you have to go to our website to get them. There are notes available for this talk, but you have to go to our website to get them. Click on handouts. Ignore that. It should say click on the title of the talk under the Pittsburgh Convention listing. And there you have both of the talks I gave today. The young earth, old earth debate I did earlier, I don't have notes for because I had no idea what was going to come up. Okay, I talked about who I am already, so I'm not going to go into that very much. But I did want to say one thing about how I got involved with what I'm doing now, because it's a bit different for most people. When I got involved in doing this, I didn't have children of my own. My wife and I were double income, no kids. We went separate ways to work every day. But I was a professor at Ball State University at the time, and as a professor at Ball State University, I started running into these incredibly gifted students who were measurably head and shoulders above the rest. And when I would ask these students, where did you go to school? They would say, at home. I didn't even know what that meant. I didn't even know if it was legal. But I ran into several students like this. And one day on my way to work, I came to the startling realization that if I considered my top three students that I experienced while I was at Ball State University, now these are in chemistry and physics. That's what I taught at the university level. My top three students all said they were schooled at home. And I thought, you know, if that's really true, if my top three students are schooled at home, I ought to learn something about what this schooling at home really is. Because it seems to be sending me my best students. So in the end, I did what every academic does. You see, we don't do anything in academics. We professors, we don't truly do anything, but we study things intensely. So what I decided to do was to study home education by going to the academic literature and seeing if there have been studies done on home education. Because seriously, whenever a scientist experiences something, be it with a person or with a naturalistic process, you have to ask yourself, is what I'm observing a representative sample or a statistical anomaly? If I see a two-headed fish, does that mean all fish have two heads? If I see a student who says he was schooled at home and he's measurably superior to my other students, does that mean the average homeschooled kid is like that? Or are these kids statistical anomalies? So I went to the research literature to see, have people studied homeschoolers? Well, turns out they have. There are a lot of studies on homeschooling. Quite frankly, we academics like to study anything that's odd. And in fact, the studies agreed with my experience that overall students who spend at least a portion of their time schooled at home are measurably superior to those who are schooled in traditional fashion, be it public or private schools. Typically, when you do these studies, if you section them this way, you see the average publicly schooled student is here, the average privately schooled student is above that, and the average homeschooled student's on top. That's generally what you see. And in fact, if you look at the statistics very closely, you'll find that generally 90% of homeschooled students score at the average for public school students, at the average or above. So 90% of homeschooled students are scoring at least as well as the average publicly schooled student. That's what the data said. So since the data were consistent with my experiences, I decided homeschooling is probably a good thing and I should probably get more involved in it. So I started working with homeschoolers and eventually writing curriculum before I even started homeschooling. And that's what's funny. If anything, that's the truly professorial way to do something. You know, people like you, experts who have been doing this for years, came to listen to me, the expert, who had never done it. I had just studied it. And because I studied it, I knew. Well, I actually learned about homeschooling when my wife and I adopt a 15-year-old child who's going to public school, and we have to actually start homeschooling her. That's when I learned two things, what homeschooling is all about, and all those things in high school that I never really learned. I learned them all, homeschooling my daughter. And of course, you know, there are very many different ways of homeschooling. The main positive effect of homeschooling is having the student learn on his or her own, whether that means always at school or always at home or 2 days in a co-op type school or 2 days in a part-time school and the rest of the days at home. That's what seems to be the key. The key is having the student learn on his or her own. So the main reason I want to tell you this is I got into this business because I saw the products. I saw the products of our public schools, our full-time private schools, and our home schools. And I have to tell you, the homeschooled students just knocked everybody's socks off. So I got into it because I saw the products. Having said all that, one thing that's very, very important to me is no matter what the schooling situation is, we need to be teaching critical thinking. Now, critical thinking is this kind of buzzword phrase that everybody uses and virtually nobody knows what it really means, and very few people actually care about it other than to simply say the phrase over and over again. But critical thinking is very important. It's a big deal for many reasons, not the least of which is people all over the world, even well-educated, intelligent people, get scammed all of the time. And financial scam is only one kind of scam. For example, there's all sorts of propaganda out there that's just factually false. But nevertheless, you see it all of the time. For example, I was watching a National Geographic video narrated by William Shatner. Now, if you can't believe Captain Kirk, but nevertheless, William Shatner was telling me that the rainforests were being plowed down at 100 square acres an hour. And I sat and thought about that, and I thought, how many square acres are there if we're plowing through them at 100 square acres every hour? Well, it turns out that in the late 90s, satellite studies were done of the major rainforests, and it turns out the major rainforests are 90% the size they've always been. So there's very little rainforest damage going on. Yet Captain Kirk tells me they're being plowed through it at 100 square acres an hour. That's clearly not correct. But it sounds so good, people believe it. When I taught chemistry at Ball State University, my freshman chemistry students, the very first question, they'd come in, I'd give them the syllabus and all that nonsense. Then I'd ask them a question. I'd say, how many of you believe that the air we're breathing now is cleaner than it was in the 70s? Virtually no one would raise their hand. How many people think it's dirtier than it was in the 70s? Virtually everyone raised their hand. Do you know that by every measurable pollutant level, we are breathing cleaner air now than we've been breathing in 30 years? The year ever since the first big EPA mandates were passed in the early 70s, the air has gotten cleaner year after year after year. Every measurable pollutant is less now. That's not what most people think, though, is it? The facts are something different than you read about or hear about. There are all sorts of money-making pyramid schemes. It continually shocks me that intelligent people think that if they send a few $100 out in the mail, they'll eventually get a few $1,000s back. Then there are products out there that make just wild claims and oftentimes rely on the fact that people aren't really going to check into them. My favorite example of this is the laundry ball. Not as popular as it is, used to be, but it used to be a very popular thing. It's this ball, and depending on which one you buy, it could look very, very elaborate. You put it in your laundry, and theoretically, you don't even need detergent. You just put it in your laundry, and it cleans your clothes. Now, it's true. The laundry ball does make your clothes cleaner. You add detergent and the laundry ball, it's cleaner than detergent alone. You add the laundry ball, it's cleaner than water alone. I'll tell you why in a second. What the manufacturer says is the laundry ball has these electrochemical properties that as it twirls around as the agitator is going, it aligns the water molecules so as to make the water wetter. Now, this is what they say. And wetter water clearly cleans clothes better than drier water. So the laundry ball is helping the washer do its job by making the water wetter. Turns out the laundry ball does clean your clothes. It cleans your clothes the same way we used to clean clothes. We used to go down to the river and scrape them against rocks. And certainly you can scrape the stains right off of a shirt if you want to scrape it against stuff. The downside, of course, is the shirt lasts only a couple of months instead of a couple of years. So in the end, the laundry ball was making things cleaner, but the same thing would happen if you put a good clean rock in there, too. Because in the end, all it was doing was scraping the clothes. And if you really investigated that, you would quickly learn that the laundry ball is way too expensive when you take into account all the new shirts you got to buy. Untrue stories that promote a certain belief or agenda. I mean, you know, as soon as a presidential election rolls around, you're guaranteed to get stories in your email and on websites about one of the two candidates that are utterly and completely false. But people believe them because they want to believe them. And then finally, I think a large reason the cults are prominent in the U.S. especially is because people don't think through the claims. If something sounds good and it meets some emotional need, they take it, rather than actually critically thinking through the claims of the cult or the group or whatever. So I think critical thinking is important because it allows us to avoid a lot of this stuff. Just being smart and just being well-educated doesn't protect you from a lot of this stuff. You need to actually think about what these people are saying. So the first thing we have to figure out is, what is critical thinking? What is it in actuality? In actuality, it's a disciplined manner of thought. And that's why most people don't do it. It's a disciplined manner of thought that's a lot of hard work. It's so much easier to kick your feet back up and read the paper. It's a lot harder to ingest this information in the paper in a disciplined manner of thought. This disciplined manner of thought tries to assess the validity of a statement, news story, argument, proposition, whatever, that is received by the brain. So as you're receiving this information, you need to try and critically evaluate it. It's based on, first and foremost, asking questions. Questions are a great way to try and focus your thinking on something. Most of you have probably made up a test or two in the time you've been educating your children. Have you ever noticed that when you actually have to sit down and write those questions, even though theoretically you're the teacher and you know the answer, you actually understand things better once you've written the questions down? Because the very fact of asking questions about a subject makes you think about it. Examining evidence. If a proposition claims to be factual, there should be some way to back it up with facts. And this is why, personally, I think Christian apologetics is so important when evangelizing people. It's very easy for me to say, God follows, listens to my prayers. I can feel Christ leading my life. But make no mistake about it. Every practitioner of every religion can say exactly the same thing about their God. In fact, I used to do atheism versus Christianity debates with a guy who said he drew strength and encouragement from his atheism. So in fact, every practitioner of every religion in the world can say things like, God, Allah, Buddha, here's my prayers. The difference is, from a Christian standpoint, it's true. And because it's true, there should be evidence for it. And that's what Christian apologetics is all about. Looking at all sides. Oftentimes, if we just look at one side of the issue, it might be a very pleasant experience for us because we agree with that issue. But we as people are fallen. We have a sinful nature. And either unconsciously or consciously, we tend to shade truths to make them fit our views. And so if I'm reading something or listening to someone always from one side of the issue, you're going to get a very shaded view. When I listen to the news, for example, I have time in generally when I'm traveling to listen to two news programs. I listen to Rush Limbaugh. I listen to National Public Radio. I get the two extremes. The answer's usually somewhere in the middle. Analyzing assumptions and biases. When someone is trying to give you some information, most likely there are assumptions and biases from which he or she is coming. That doesn't mean it's wrong. That's not even bad. It simply means you have to know the assumptions and biases going in so that you're fully informed. You not only know the proposition he or she's giving, but the assumptions and biases from which it comes. And then finally, this is probably the hardest of all. Avoiding emotion and personal desires. I'm telling you, there are some things that I've heard that I would really, really, really love to be true. I'm going to show you one in a second. I would really love for this to be true. But the fact is, it's not. And it doesn't do any good to the cause of Christ or anything else for me to start spreading this lie around. All right? So even though I really, really want it to be true, I better make sure it's true before I start embarrassing myself and in the end embarrassing a whole worldview as a result of me being duped simply because of my emotion and personal desires. In the end, if we can try and formulate a disciplined manner of thought that relies on these kind of steps, I think we can be well on our way to analyzing things critically. And please understand, that's the key of critical thinking. Critical in this sense, has no negative connotation whatsoever. You know, my daughter is incredibly critical of my driving. That's a negative connotation. She won't even let me drive when we're in the car together. So she's an adult, so we can argue about these things. But she's critical of my driving. That's a negative connotation. Critical thinking is not a negative connotation. Critical thinking is a way of analyzing propositions and trying to find the truth, which is a very positive thing. So let me tell you the thing I would really love to be true. This is something I get every now and again in email. I see it on websites. I even see it in some print. The reason I decided to choose this one to show you is because I received it from a fellow who's a really good friend, considered one of the funniest men I've ever met. But he hates science, has no desire to learn any science whatsoever. He's a playwright. And so he got this story in his email, and he forwarded it to me, and he said, "This has to be wrong. Please tell me why." So even though he knows no science at all, and this is a science story, he knew it was wrong simply because he could think critically. He didn't need to know the scientific error in this. Well, here's the error, here's the story. Mr. Harold Hill, okay, that already bothers me. If you know the American Musical Theater, Harold Hill's the fast-talking salesman that sells you the band stuff and then leaves. Okay, Mr. Harold Hill claims that an engineering team at NASA was running orbit calculations for the planets in the solar system. The idea being NASA wants to throw up a few satellites into space. If they want to throw up a few satellites into space, they need to know where all the planets are before they can do that. They were running these orbit calculations back and forth over the centuries. Okay, so they were going forward, going backwards, and so forth. As they were going back, the computer suddenly stopped and generated an error message saying there was a day missing. But the computers couldn't account for the day that seemed to be missing, and until they could account for this day, they couldn't go any further. And of course, the engineering team scratching its head, trying to figure out what in the world could this be. And this janitor walks by, hears their discussion about this missing day, and says, "Hey, haven't you guys gone to Sunday school? In Joshua, commands the sun to stand still in the sky for about a whole day." And the scientists say, "Well, that's not bad, but this says exactly a day. These computers are saying 24 hours, not about a whole day." Well, the janitor thinks some more and says, "Well, there's another story in 2 Kings when Isaiah commands the sun to move backwards in the sky 10 degrees. I bet if you add that to the sun being still in the sky, you get a full day." And so the NASA team was very thankful for this helpful janitor's help in them figuring out this problem. Now, this story is obviously wrong. There's a scientific error, which I'll tell you in a minute. You could also tell I'm a chemist, because rather than saying orbit, I say orbital, and that's a chemist's term. It really should say orbit, not orbital, but that's because I'm a chemist. So in any event, there is a scientific error there, but you don't need to know the scientific error. Anybody should be able to figure out this story is false. First of all, you have to ask questions. Now, these questions are not designed to stump, to prove the assumption or the proposition incorrect. They are simply designed to make you think more about the proposition. So, for example, you could ask the question, why would the scientists run the calculations backwards? After all, they're just trying to predict where the planets are the next time they launch a satellite. Why would they go backwards? Easy answer to that. They're trying to make sure the orbit calculations are correct to begin with. And what they can do is run them backwards and see if they can reproduce what happened in the past. Now we have another question. How would the computers know what happened in the past? Well, theoretically, we've been measuring the position of the planets for a long time. Perhaps somebody fed all that information into the computer. So the computer was continually comparing the information or the measured values to the orbit calculations. Of course, you have to wonder if we can really go all the way back to the days of Joshua and have good enough orbit, planetary measurements to know these things. But nevertheless, I guess that's possible. Why hasn't this been made public? That's pretty easy. NASA's an evolutionary organization. They're certainly not going to want to produce stuff that makes the Bible look good and such. So, these questions don't necessarily stump the proposition, but they do make you think about it a little more. You need to examine evidence as well. The problem is there's no real evidence given in the story. And in fact, there's no references that says, if you really want to learn about this, go here. And in fact, it's the orbit calculations that are the big thing in this story, and there's no particulars about the orbit calculations. So in the end, there's no evidence. Does this mean it's wrong? No. It may mean that the communicator is just really bad at documenting things. But it should automatically make it a little less believable when there's no evidence for it. Analyzing assumptions and biases. There's no such thing as an independent anything. There's no such thing as an independent journalist, no such thing as an independent scientist. We all have our assumptions and biases. They're not necessarily bad, but we need to know about them going in. Here's how the story starts. Did you know that the space program is busy proving that what has been called a myth in the Bible is true? So this tells you the assumption and bias. This guy is trying to prove to you that the Bible is true. That's certainly not a bad thing, but you need to know that going in. And as I told you before, it was a janitor, a Christian janitor, who is credited for figuring out the error and managing to enlighten these trained scientists. This certainly can happen. Sometimes out of the mouths of babes, great truths are spoken. So I'm not saying that's not possible. I'm just saying, once again, it's an assumption or a bias. Now, here's the real one. I would love to just click forward and send it to all my friends. Look, NASA's proving that, in fact, the sun stood still in Joshua's time in the sky, and also the sun went backwards in the sky in Isaiah's time. So I would love this to be true. And in fact, what about the irony? Here we've got evolution-based NASA proving the Bible. So not only is it a good story, there's a lot of great irony there. But before I click forward to all of it in my address book, maybe I ought to get NASA's view on this. You know, now they could seriously be lying, but to cover up. But nevertheless, if I'm going to read Harold Hill's view, I better read NASA's view as well. All you have to do is go to NASA's website, in their search box, put missing day, and you find a complete refutation of the story. In fact, it references you to a book you can buy, or you can get at the library, that existed long before computers. And in the story, it wasn't originally computers, it was simply equations they were working out on paper. And it got to the point where the equations couldn't be solved because of the missing day. And so then this story just got updated. As a matter of fact, the book predates NASA as well. Not only predates computers, but it predates NASA. So in the end, the story is an old one that's simply been updated to make it look more modern. In fact, one thing I did in preparation for this talk years ago when I started giving this talk is I called 10 of the local libraries, the closest libraries in my area, and I just asked the reference librarians. I've run across this story. Any way to know whether it's true or not? 7 of the 10 told me where I could go to find that the story's not true. So in the end, it wasn't very even hard to look at both sides and see that there's something wrong with the story. Now, does anyone know the science error in the story? I don't expect anybody to know it. But around Earth. They're putting them around Earth. That's it. NASA's putting the satellites around Earth, and where Jupiter is just has no bearing on how a satellite moves around Earth. Earth's magnetic field gravitational field is, of course, smaller than Jupiter's gravitational field, but Jupiter is so much farther away that it exerts virtually no influence on the moon or any other satellite of the Earth. So I don't have to tell where I don't even have to tell where Venus and Mars are, which are the two closest to us. I don't even have to tell that. All I need to know is where the moon is and where any space junk might be so that I don't run into those things. Other than that, it really doesn't matter. So that's the science error, but you don't need to know that. All you have to do is think critically about this, and if nothing else, like my friend, you can see there's enough glaring problems to at least question it rather than immediately believe it just because it sounds so good. So, of course, the question becomes, how do we teach this to our children? How do we get our children to think critically and at the same time not become overly skeptical or overly critical? Well, I'm going to give you sort of the broad view first. I'm going to give you the broad view first, and then I'm going to give you specific suggestions within this broad view. First of all, you can have them learn from history. History is a great teacher. In the classical model, you do a lot about history and such. History is a great teacher. It allows us to see how silly we all can really be at times. And so there are past examples of people not thinking critically. You can read commentaries on this. There's a lot of commentaries, for example, about the Black Plague. Black Plague was sweeping across Europe. Nobody knew what to do. So what did they start doing? They started killing the cats. They're killing the cats because they were the witches' familiars. And it was God upset about the witches. Turns out that the cats were the one thing that could have helped them because the Black Plague was carried by rats. So in the end, you can read commentaries of examples like that talk to see about people not thinking critically. Also, you can just examine past examples. Whenever in history we're learning about something that really shows people weren't thinking too clearly, you can highlight that and ask your child, why is it you think they believe that? Why is it you think this was such a prominent view back then? So they can learn these things from history. One of the best ways to teach a student that there's more than one side to every story, or to most stories anyway, is to have them examine current controversies. Now, obviously, you have to exercise some discernment here. Your goal, first and foremost, is to train them up in the ways of the Lord. But also, you do want to show them that there are different views out there. So when they're of the proper age and the proper discernment level and so forth, you can have them examine current controversies that you have a solid belief of what's right, but you have to at least acknowledge there are other relatively intelligent people out there that believe something else. And so it might be nice to look at that. All sorts of political issues. You know, two politicians can stand up and claim exactly the opposite thing and be so fervent in their claim. Examine both sides of some political issue. Lots of science issues that have a lot of controversy, from, you know, court cases, creation, evolution, whether or not to vaccinate your child. These are all things that are controversial in one group or another. Find a group for which this is, find a controversial issue within a group that you're in, and have them look at it. I think if you happen to see the old Earth, young Earth debate that we did right before lunch, that was a great example of that. To really show that even though you may passionately believe in one side or the other, there are very intelligent, very informed people who are Christians and being very honest who disagree with you. And that's important. You can encourage them to be skeptical of people's and products' claims. And let me make clear what I'm talking about here. When I talk about people's claims, you know, at some point you ought to be modeling to your child that when you go and hear the preacher say something, you go home and you check it against the Word. That's something you should be modeling to your children. That's being skeptical. Just because he's the preacher doesn't mean he's always saying the truth. Be kept skeptical of the product's claims. When you go to my table and you ask me, what's the best science curriculum I can get? What do you think I'm going to say? Right? When I'm trying to sell you something, you know, I'm going to try and paint it in the best light. So you've got to be skeptical of both people's and product's claim. One thing that's kind of prevalent these days, and it's kind of, it's sad that people can be this deceitful, but, you know, there are a lot of, like, homeschooling websites, for example, where you can post your own review. Amazon does this as well. You can post your own review of a book or a curriculum or something like that. It's been shown on Amazon, and it was recently shown on a homeschooling website, that these reviewers, who all have different names and so forth, all came from exactly the same IP address, which means exactly the same computer. So Deb in Arlington, Texas, and Janine in Boca Raton, Florida, both were using the exact same computer to post this review. What does that tell you? You know, so in the end, you've got to be skeptical of people's and products' claims. And in the end, if you are doing curriculum at home, if you've got a situation where you're choosing curriculum, you can choose curriculum that encourages critical thinking. So this is the broad view. Now I want to go back and talk about specific examples. And my goal here is not only to give you things that you can use, but also I want to stretch your mind a little bit too. Okay, so talking about history, looking at specific past events from history. One of the most famous pieces of history from the creation evolution standpoint is the fossil known as Piltdown Man. This is an example of evolutionists not thinking critically. Basically, there was a fossil found by Charles Dawson. He was an amateur fossil hunter. Turns out this fossil was a fake. It wasn't Charles Dawson who did the fake. Somebody obviously knew he was digging and planted it there. But anyway, it was a poorly faked fossil that was supposed to be a transitional form from apes to humans. If you read the commentaries, and I'm going to give you some commentaries in a second, the commentaries indicate the forgery was very poor, but the evolutionists bought it anyway. Now, I think they bought it because they needed it, but nevertheless, it was considered an absolute transitional form between apes and humans for more than 40 years. Stephen Gould writes about it in his book, The Panda's Thumb, More Reflections on Natural History. This is an evolutionary book, but it really does bash evolutionists for accepting Piltdown Man for so long. There's a comprehensive website here. Now, all of this is in the notes on our website. So if you don't want to have to write all this down in a couple seconds, just go to our website, get the notes, and you've got all of this. In the end, both of these are evolutionary sources, but they show you in detail how poorly the fossil was faked. Basically, like the teeth, for example, had to be filed. They were human teeth, but they were filed down to look more ape-like. You could actually see the file marks on the teeth. But for 40 years, evolutionists seemed to ignore that. The cranium was from a human being, and so did the teeth. And so in order to make them look old, they were stained. And it turns out the staining job was poor enough that you could tell it was fake. But nevertheless, evolutionists bought it for a long time. This is a great example of people not thinking critically because there was something they wanted to believe. And these commentaries really bring that out. Now, let's make it clear. Evolutionists aren't the only people that don't think critically from time to time. I'm not sure if you remember Y2K. But I certainly do. I was doing the homeschool convention circuit back then, and virtually every other homeschool convention I went to had someone speaking from the stage saying that Y2K was going to be the end of the world as we knew it, and that you got to buy a lot of dried grain and so forth to survive it. And unfortunately, this was centered almost exclusively in the Christian community. Not 100%, but the vast majority of Y2K hysteria came from the Christian community. In this situation, there aren't a lot of resources that examine why this happened, but what's nice is we know what really happened. Now that we know what really happened, we can go back and examine what people were thinking. You can pick up this book pretty cheap these days. The Millennium Bug, How to Survive the Coming Chaos by Michael Hyatt. And this shows you his arguments that lots of people bought into. I don't mean to say even a majority of Christians bought into it, but of the people who bought into it, the majority came from the Christian community. Then, of course, on the other side, another Christian, David Hunt, Y2K, a reasoned response to mass hysteria. If you look at both of these resources, you can get a feel for why is it that Michael Hyatt's view became popular among some Christians, whereas David Hunt's view did not. You can read both books or parts of each book that talk about the same thing, and maybe have the right student write an essay or talk to you about why is it the people bought into this. What is it about Michael Hyatt's arguments that seem to make sense to a subsection of Christian people? So that's an example where we don't have a lot of commentaries, but you can look at the past and see examples of us not thinking critically. And it's very important, you know, it's so easy for us to concentrate on those folks who disagree with us, you know, but we have a lot of faults too, and that needs to be brought out because everybody has faults. If we talk about controversial issues, there are a lot of fun controversial issues that can also be woven into a curriculum. For example, when I taught at the Gifted and Talented High School that I taught at, this is something I did every year as a part of my chemistry course. I had them read a chapter from each of these books. Environmental Overkill, Whatever Happened to Common Sense by Dixie Lee Ray, and Earth in the Balance by former Vice President Al Gore. These present two completely different views of environmental issues. And they both use science, and they both claim to be correct scientifically. They both claim to be demonstrably correct. Okay, that probably can't be true. Since they're almost opposite views, they probably both can't be correct. However, we don't truly know who's correct and who's not. But the student could read, say, the chapter on global warming in this book, the chapter on global warming in that book, and then write an essay or talk to you a little bit about whose arguments make more sense and why. And why is it that you like these arguments as opposed to those arguments? So that's a way of looking at both sides where we don't truly know the answer yet. Obviously, one has to use discernment, but at some level, you want them to do studies on evolution. Now, the fundamental thing we all want to do is give them a lot of books by Hugh Ross or a lot of books by Answers in Genesis and so forth that truly show creation to be correct. But the fact is, the other side writes a lot of books too, and at some level, the student really needs to know there are other views out there. And in fact, you'll see what I'm in a moment on a different issue, why it really is important to read both views, because in the end, the folks who are trying to convince you of something do tend to color the facts. Of all of the evolutionary books that are out there, this is one of the most honest. It's called The Blind Watchmaker, Why Evidence of Evolution Reveals a Universe Without Design by Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins honestly admits to the problems of evidence in evolution. However, he honestly admits, I'm not choosing creation, so here's why I choose evolution. But nevertheless, he makes his case for evolution in this book. And I point him out because unlike some authors, I think Stephen Gould, for example, in his popular works, not a very honest person when he writes. Richard Dawkins, very honest person when he writes. What is Creation Science by Morrison Parker is an example of the other side. There are a lot of good other books, and most of us have the books we like. But it's important to show the students the side that we happen to disagree with. Now, you don't do this when they're seven, you know, but you do it when they're ready to start evaluating other people's views. I want to camp out on this one a little bit because it's the best example I can come up with of why it's important to look at the other side of the issue. You may or may not be aware that there are a lot of people that believe vaccination's a bad thing and that people should not vaccinate their children. The average doctor is going to tell you, well, of course you need to vaccinate your children, but there are some very strong anti-vaccination advocates who claim to use a lot of science to show that you shouldn't be vaccinating your children. What's really nice about this is it gives you a feeling for why it's important to look at both sides. The anti-side, this is probably the Bible of the anti-side. Vaccines, are they really safe and effective? A Parent's Guide to Childhood Shots by Neil Miller. This is sort of a website that's basically his arguments on the web. On the pro side, you can go to Offutt and Bell, Vaccines, What Every Parent Should Know, and then my website, so you know where I'm coming from on this issue. so know that assumption and bias up front. So anyway, you can look at both sides of this issue. Here's why it's important. Let's suppose I go to a pro-vaccination website and or book. And I'll see a graph that looks something like this, maybe a different disease, maybe a different country, but you'll see a graph look something like this. This is pertussis, whooping cough, in the UK. UK has great medical records. Since they're more of a nanny state than the US, they keep great medical records on everyone. So in the end, you can learn, there's a lot of good records out there. So you can plot the number of pertussis cases in the United Kingdom from about 1940 to the present. And you can see that at first it's a jagged line, but nevertheless, the peaks are pretty high. Mass immunization starts right here, and immediately there's a decrease. Then there's a little bump here that I'm going to get to in a second, and then a decrease again. But in the end, there seems to be a direct decrease right after mass immunization starts. This, of course, from the pro side, is great evidence that vaccines are incredibly effective. Now let's go to the anti side. Go to an anti book or website. You'll see a very, very similar graph. Once again, pertussis in the UK from 1940 to the present day. In this case, however, there's no big correlation between the drop-off when mass immunization starts. In fact, things were dropping off long before mass immunization starts. Therefore, vaccines aren't effective at all. They didn't affect the rate of pertussis at all. The key here is to understand that both of these graphs are 100% true. The difference is they're plotting something quite different. This is plotting pertussis cases. This is plotting pertussis deaths. Big difference. One of the first things medical science learns whenever faced with a new disease is how to deal with the symptoms. If you can deal with the symptoms, you can often keep the person alive enough for his or her own immune system to work. And in the end, pertussis, this is a clear example of this. Once people understood, these young kids are coughing themselves to death because they can't breathe well enough in between coughs. One of the quick things to do, give them an oxygen mask. Pump them full of oxygen so even when they take a tiny breath, they get a lot of oxygen, rather than the 21% that's in the air that we normally breathe. So in the end, doctors were able to treat pertussis long before they were able to prevent it. As a result, pertussis death started falling basically as soon as pertussis was characterized. However, pertussis cases didn't start falling until immunization. So the question is not, are they effective? The question is, what are they effective at? They're effective at preventing the disease, but they don't change death rates very much. So the question isn't, you know, whether it's, the question is, do you want your child to skip pertussis, or is it okay to get pertussis just as long as the child doesn't die? If the latter, then you probably don't need to vaccinate, because most likely, even if you get pertussis, the child's not going to die. However, if you want them to skip pertussis, and pertussis can have long-term consequences other than death, blindness, deafness, things like that. But in any event, if you want them to skip pertussis, that's what vaccination is really good at, not necessarily decreasing the chance of death. Now, you might be interested, there's this little bump here. Pertussis death cases were falling, and suddenly there's this bump of increase. Where did this increase come from? Well, it's very interesting. This is another example that really shows how a vaccine stopped disease. In the early 70s, the vaccination rate in the UK decreased significantly because there were people who believed that the pertussis vaccine was causing sudden infant death syndrome. There were a couple of papers published very early that indicated that a child with a vaccination was slightly more likely to die of SIDS. As a result, vaccination rates plummeted in the UK. This isn't true for other countries. In the US, they didn't, for example, but in the UK, they did. When vaccination rates started decreasing, pertussis rates shot right back up again. So by the mid-80s, there was a national campaign in the UK to start pertussis vaccination again because SIDS hadn't decreased at all, but pertussis had increased a lot. So in the end, this massive campaign program started, vaccination rates started to increase again, and pertussis rates went down. But the key is, if I had looked at just one site, I'd only get one half of the story. This is my favorite one, and this you really need to wrap your head around. Let's go to a pro site. And the pro site will say, you know, measles outbreaks occur in school, and when those outbreaks occur, we know about them and so forth, and we can track the students who get measles outbreaks and whether or not they've been vaccinated. When a measles outbreak occurs in a school, the vaccinated children are 22 times less likely to contract the disease than our unvaccinated children. So your chance of getting the measles, according to the pro site, is incredibly small if you're vaccinated. The anti-site you go to, and it says, well, you know, measles outbreaks occur in school, and when that happens, we can track students and compare their vaccination histories and so forth. And we find that when a measles outbreak occurs in the school, the majority of students, usually about 60%, are the ones who get the disease, are the vaccinated students. So here, vaccination is supposed to make it incredibly unlikely for you to get the disease. Here, vaccination, the majority of students who get the disease are vaccinated. Once again, both statements are 100% true. The reason they're 100% true is this side is not telling you something. This side is not telling you that 99% of the students in a school are vaccinated. All this side is telling you is the chance of getting the disease is real low if you're vaccinated. But however, even though the chance is real low, if you have a huge number of vaccinated students, even a tiny percentage of those is going to outweigh 100% of the other group of students. So if I have 1,000 people and they're 22 times less likely, I'm still going to get 5 or 6 that have measles. If 2 of them aren't vaccinated and both of those get the disease, I'll have 2 who weren't vaccinated that got the disease, 5 or 6 that were vaccinated that got the disease. So the majority of students that get the disease were vaccinated, but that's because their population was the biggest to begin with. This, in my opinion, is not a normalized sample. This is. So in the end, the key here is when you're looking at both sides, you end up learning more. You end up learning how one side is coloring the view compared to the other. Okay, so that's looking at both sides, looking at controversial issues. Encourage your children to be skeptical of people's and products' claims. This is something I found with my daughter. It was actually in the newspaper, and I looked at it. And I gave it to my daughter and I said, you see anything unusual about this article? And it was an article about a brand new weight loss drug. And I asked her, you know, do you see anything unusual about this article? And she looked at it for a while and she said, well, the only thing that's unusual here is they give you an 800 number to call. That usually doesn't happen in most news articles. But other than that, I didn't see anything. I said, well, look above the headline. What's the little word above the headline? The little word above the headline is advertisement. It looked like a real news story, but it was an ad. It was supposed to look like a news story, so you would think that it was an unbiased reporter writing copy for this. But here's what it said. Yes, this is a totally different kind of reducing program that each day blocks out both fat and sugar calories by the hundreds from entering your system. It actually neutralizes the calorie in all the foods you eat before those excess calories can turn to flab and fat. So far, I'm willing to believe it's possible. Here's what bothers me. And that slims you down and firms you up faster, safer, and surer than even total starvation. I think the kids in Ethiopia might disagree with that statement. Yes, it melts down fat and carbs away inches so fast that in the first 48 hours alone, excess fat burns away so that you will lose a full pound every 8 hours, up to 3 pounds every day. And what's interesting about this, it doesn't say it tapers off. So, you know, 70 days and I'm dead. I'm zero. Okay, 75 days. In the story, you see words like clinically proven, money-back guarantee. There are even a couple of testimonials. You go to their website, they have even more testimonials. The key here is there's not a piece of scientific evidence that says this works. All right? The reason I asked my daughter to look at it was because to show her that sometimes advertisements are made to look like news stories to give them more credibility. The other things I pointed out to my little girl is that clinically proven now means nothing. At one time it actually meant something, but clinically proven now means I gave it to 5 of my friends and they said it worked. Money-back guarantee. It's incredibly important to understand that a money-back guarantee only guarantees you one thing. You're not risking your money if you bother to take advantage of it. But that's all it says. It doesn't mean that the product is good. We offer a money-back guarantee on our curriculum, but that doesn't mean it's good. It just means that if you bother to take advantage of the money-back guarantee, you haven't wasted any money. There was a weight loss drug, one of the early weight loss drugs on the market called Grapefruit 45. It actually had a lawsuit against it because there seemed to be something other than grapefruit in it. And when the corporate books were opened up, the business model was, we know this doesn't work. We will offer a money-back guarantee because we know only about 50% of the nation will actually take advantage of it. So we'll simply price the product so that we can afford to give the money back 50% of the time and we'll still make money. That's all a money-back guarantee means. And then, of course, testimonials really honestly don't mean a thing. We have testimonials all through our catalog, and all it means is for some reason it worked for them. I have to tell you, one of the most interesting psychological experiments I ever read, put a group of people like this, just sitting like in pews or chairs or something, bring in a witch doctor, and these all people are all suffering from a cold. Bring in a witch doctor in full makeup and everything. Let him do his dance, shake his rattles and so forth, and leave. And about 10% of the people will say, he cured my cold. Now, if you use those same rattles, but now give them in the hands of a man in a white lab coat with a stethoscope around his neck, and he comes and does the same dance with the same rattles and says, you're now cured, 20% of the people will say they're cured. In the U.S., I'm sure in Africa it's probably the other way around, but in the U.S., making him look like a doctor makes it more effective. This is actually in science called the rattle effect. And when you design a scientific experiment having to do with medicine, you have to take into account the rattle effect. And typically you do that by having a control group that thinks they're getting treated but aren't, a control group that's really getting treated, and then you compare the groups rather than individuals. But the important thing is testimonials could all be from the group that said the rattle cured them. So it doesn't mean anything except it happened to work for them for some reason. Now, in all this idea of being skeptical of people's and products claims, the internet is a great resource for information. It's also a great resource for lies. Some of the things you might have heard before, Oliver North did not warn of the terrorism of Osama bin Laden during the Iran-Contra hearings. He did warn about terrorism. He even mentioned a name, but it was not Osama bin Laden. George Bush did not wish to witness to a teen and lead him to Christ during a thank you banquet. George Bush's staff said he would have loved to do that, but he didn't. Charles Darwin did not renounce evolution and become a Christian on his deathbed. We can actually point to the woman who started that lie. Her name was Lady Hope. She was the wife of the admiral of the British Royal Navy. We know that's a lie, but nevertheless, it's very popular in the Christian community. To avoid being fooled by things like that, it's nice to go to some place who's done a little bit of the fact-checking already. One of my favorite places is trutherfiction.com. What's nice about trutherfiction.com, first of all, it's run by evangelicals, but secondly, it has three categories: truth, fiction, undecided. So they at least try and gather all the facts that they know, and then if they can't decide, they at least give you the facts and let you decide. So anyway, you need to evaluate stuff you get. Stories may sound good. I really wish George Bush had led someone to Christ. I really wish Darwin had renounced evolution. But the fact is they didn't. And all you have to do is look at the evidence to see that. So, if we're teaching our children at home or having some voice in the curriculum choices, there are curriculum that helps encourage this. One of my favorite books for late junior high is Critical Conditioning by Catherine Stout. Basically, this is a book that's on reading comprehension. So I guess it's late elementary, early junior high is really where it comes into play. And, you know, reading comprehension is important because hopefully as the child gets older, you're going to be letting him or her learn more on his or her own. So in the end, your student's going to have to comprehend what's being read. So this is a reading comprehension book, but what she uses is the steps of critical thinking to help guide them in how to remember things. If you're asking questions, you're more likely to remember it later on. You know, if you're critically thinking about it, you're more likely to comprehend it and remember it later on. Everybody's got to do geography. I somehow got out of school without geography. I honestly believed, before I started traveling, as an adult I believed this, that Arizona was in the Pacific Northwest. So I clearly had no geography. Geography is one of the things I learned once I started traveling, but also when I started homeschooling my daughter. but in any event, most people are supposed to take geography. This is one of the best geography programs. Now, we sell a geography program. It's called Around the World in 180 Days. But I think this is a great geography program as well because it actually has critical thinking exercises as a part of geography. And that's pretty great because, you know, geography sometimes degenerates into here's a country, here's its capital, here's a country, here's its capital. And this has a lot of good critical thinking exercises as a part of learning geography. Once again, all of these are in the notes on the website, all the contact information, because we don't sell hardly any of these. Building thinking skills by critical thinking books and software. This particular program I would only use if you really think you got a gullible kid on your hands. If you really think you got, you know, ask them if gullible's in the dictionary. if you tell them gullible's not in the dictionary and they say, really? Then you might want to think about. And you probably wouldn't use all of these books, but you'd use one or two occasionally. There are five books depending on what grade level the student is. And it really builds the idea of trying to look for problems in statements and trying to critically examine statements. Now, whereas this I don't think would be used unless you think you have a problem, here's something that could be used for everyone. In the K through 6 range, there are a lot of good curricula out there. We sell a K through 6 elementary curriculum that's pretty good. But one of the things that's wonderful about K through 6 is there's nothing that's content specific in science. There's nothing the student has to learn. So in the end, you can have fun and you can play a little bit. This is a great series of books to play with and make it part of your science curriculum. It's developing critical thinking through science, and it's with critical thinking books and software as well. There are two volumes. Book one is for the younger students. Book two is for the older. And I would really say 4 through 6. They say it's 4 through 8. I'd say 4 through 6. So this is two books you can use as a part of your K through 6 curriculum. What it is it's a bunch of household experiments that mostly work. And for the ones that actually do work for you, there are questions you ask the student to try and guide the student to understanding the experiment. And, of course, you have the answers to those questions. So, but in the end, it's just a really good way of trying to teach your child the logical, ordered thinking that is necessary to work through an experiment. Arguments A1, this is critical thinking activities to improve writing skills. This is a lot like what I was talking about with the environmentalist debate. This guy gives you activities where you write an argumentative paper, but in writing this argumentative paper, you basically have to read an argument you disagree with and try and refute it. So it's getting you to look at the other side, getting you to think through the other side's issues. This is good for late junior high, early high school. There's a guy named David Quine that has a whole curriculum called Cornerstone Curriculum. It has a lot of different things. It's got a good math. Unfortunately, I don't think the math in the high school years, the algebra and the pre-algebra, is necessarily complete. I don't think it's deep enough, but it really teaches you why math works, and it teaches you a lot of the concepts behind math and causes you to really think critically through math problems. He's also got music, arts, and worldview curriculum. All of this stresses analyzing assumptions, asking questions about the material, and so forth. And then, of course, I'm going to tell you that my stuff does a pretty good job. when it comes to critical thinking as well. One of the things we really try and do in our curriculum, if you ask students who use our curriculum, what are the hardest questions in the book? A lot of them will tell you it's the on-your-own questions that are right there in the reading. So you're reading for a while. A lot of textbooks, when you read for a while and you get to a question, the question is basically asking you to regurgitate something you read. And all you have to do is look for that paragraph where it's talked about and write the sentence down. What we try and do in these questions is to try and get the student to actually think through the material. So we typically ask questions where they actually have to draw a conclusion based on the material rather than simply regurgitate what they learned. Regurgitating what you learned is an important act, and it's done in the study guide section of the book. But nevertheless, to try and get them to thinking through what they've learned so that they can analyze these things, that's what we do. So anyway, I think our stuff's pretty good at that too. So that's all the time I have, but I do always want to leave a little bit of time for questions in case there are. And this is your last chance unless you want to come to my booth where I'm going to try and hawk a book on you. So if you want to ask a question, now's a good time. Yes. Well, this is a question. Public health is an interesting problem, right? It's an interesting thing to be in. If you didn't hear her question, George Bush says that if a bird flu breaks out, he's going to quarantine sections where it's going to happen. The nice thing about quarantining is, although it doesn't stop, it does severely reduce the spread because people have to be very creative. I mean, people can get into this country from Mexico, so obviously a quarantine is not going to work 100%, but it is going to reduce the spread. But you're right. If I say, okay, everybody's got bird flu in this area, so I'm just going to let you all breathe on each other and die, so to save everybody else, Is that a very moral thing to do? I'm not sure. I'm honestly not going to say whether that's a moral thing to do. From a public health standpoint, it's the right thing to do, whether it's moral or not, because the public health standpoint is, how can I get the most people to survive and be healthy? All right? From a moral standpoint, that's a difference. But here's, as a Christian, what I think my response would be. My response would be, I don't care if I die, so I'm going to go to one of those quarantine areas and help these people, because my life insurance is paid. You know, I know where I'm going. So in the end, as a Christian, my job would be, if he's quarantining these areas, depending on what my marital status and family situation, all that is, that's something a Christian should think about, is going in and ministering to the people, like, you know, Christians ministered to leopards and things like that back in the old days. So that's the only thing I would say. But yeah, the public health is a very difficult thing to really make a strong decision. I personally don't think the likelihood of bird flu breaking out is very high. It's always possible that the virus can jump to humans and then be made contagious. The virus is known to jump to humans already, but so far can't be made contagious among humans. And that's a pretty big molecular leap. So the chance of this happening is low. Unfortunately, a politician is forced to realize that if it happens on his watch and he didn't do anything about it, he's going to be written up in history very, very badly. So I can see why Bush is spending billions of dollars on something that will probably never happen. I just don't think it's probably the right thing to do, because it's so unlikely. Why spend billions on it? The Jeannie Fulbright books. Oh, that's a good question. We have our elementary series is not written by me because I don't. I'm not able to communicate at that level. We have another. We have another author, Jeannie Fulbright, who's excellent at that, just purely excellent at that. And her books, she was asking if they promote critical thinking. I think to a degree. I mean, you're talking about a different level of thinking at this point, but I do think it at least promotes them to think about the consequences of the facts they learn. So, for example, one quick thing I can think of is in astronomy, she has this activity of how radar works. And so you make this box and you put sort of a surface in the box that has hills and valleys out of paper mache or just rolled up newspaper or something. Then you cover the box, and the student uses this bamboo skewer and makes a little grid on the top of the on the cover of the box, sticks that bamboo skewer in, and draws a little gridded map of how deeply the bamboo skewer went. And from that, the student can decide, here's a valley underneath here, and here's a hill underneath here. Now, that's a kind of critical thinking. It's not high level, but it clearly is a kind of critical thinking. So rather than just being told, we can't see the base of Venus, we can't see the surface of Venus, but radar tells us it looks like this, they now have an idea not only of how radar works, but they've done some elementary deductive reasoning, you know, using radar ideas. So yeah, I do think it promotes it, but it's such a different level. It's more, in the classical view, I guess, it's more the grammar stage. So you're not doing as much thinking as really knowing facts. But whenever you can get them, thinking is a good thing. Okay, well, thank you very much for your kind attention. I will be at my booth if you want to come talk to me later. I do have to tear down here, though, so the next person can come in and get ready.